You're listening to the Young Arthroplasty Group Augment podcast channel, part of AAKUS Amplified from the American Association of Hip and Knee Surgeons, advancing hip and knee patient care through education, advocacy, research, and outreach.
Thank you, everyone. Welcome to the Young Arthroplasty Group's episode of The Augment, our podcast focusing on various topics, and we're welcome and proud to be here at the AAKUS annual meeting with Dr. Rich Iorio, who really needs no introduction. I'm Brian Chalmers, practicing out of the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City.
And I'm Connor King, a private practice surgeon in Bend, Oregon.
Great. Well, welcome, Dr. Iorio. Very honored to have you here. Today, we wanted to talk about business and arthroplasty and have our young viewers and listeners learn more about that. We had the pleasure to interview Dr. Courtney with the advocacy side and talking about topics in business and advocacy. So it's great to get your opinions and feedback. And so obviously, one of the big topics from our young learners, either early on, and we're trying to get more residents and fellows involved, or different type of practice models, and I know you talked about that in the business course that you had yesterday. Can you kind of talk about the kind of evolving landscape of, is it looking more private practice or ASC type, models with buy-ins or hospital employed, or kind of what's that landscape looking like, and do you see a lot of changes coming in the future?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. AAKUS is thriving, so the business of arthroplasty meetings is going well, but the business of arthroplasty is a challenge, and I think we all realize that. I think we could talk about some overarching trends. In 2022, half of the hospitals in the country lost money. I think we all know that the margins for arthroplasty for the business line of total joint replacement has been challenged in a bricks and mortar setting. We realize that if you do more of these things at an ASC, it's not that they cost less, it's that you're able to send people home, not have the bricks and mortars cost associated with the arthroplasty. You still have to pay for an implant, you still have to pay for anesthesia and the various materials that go into the procedure, but you're able to generate a little bit better margin because the reimbursement for arthroplasty in an ASC setting is a little bit better. So we basically have a bifurcated market, right? We have the legacy hospitals, the bricks and mortar hospitals, trying to do hospital outpatient department arthroplasty in old-time settings with inefficient operating rooms. And then we have private practice aggressive groups doing things in ASCs that they control. And obviously, it's a lot easier to do this in an ASC or a setting that we control the mechanisms of how we deliver care. Unfortunately, not everyone has access to that, right? In New York, Brian, where you practice, it's very expensive to build an ASC. You need to partner with somebody. Not very many docs have enough money to build their own ASC, right? They need to partner, and then they end up with small control of the procedure. In Massachusetts, it's a certificate of need state. There's very few ASCs. You can't go out and build one. I think we're 48th in the country. I think Vermont is 50th. So, the Northeast is not really friendly to certificate of need. So, as a result, unless you're in a large private practice group that controls an ASC, it's difficult to make a living. It's harder and harder. You have less leverage with insurance contractors. You have less leverage with the hospitals. The larger you are, the better off you are. Hence the advent of supergroups. There are 20-something large orthopedic groups with over 100 surgeons in them, and they're all very, very successful. They have challenges too, but the larger you are, the more leverage you have. Academic centers are going to survive. They have challenges too, but not everyone wants to do academics. Many of our members are going more toward employed models. We're up over 50% now. And that's a very comfortable arrangement for most people. There's no risk. Their first contract is generally very good. The second contract becomes a challenge. But it's a safer environment, better lifestyle. And for some, when I first came into practice, I was in a multi-specialty group at Lay Clinic and loved it. Thought I was going to stay there my whole life. And then things changed, right? There was no longer a defined benefit pension. All of a sudden, the way we practiced medicine was challenged because they became more RVU-oriented. And all of a sudden, the benefits of a group practice were not really there. So I went to New York and practiced in an orthopedic specialty hospital at NYU. And as you know, Brian, that's the best, right? But we don't all have that opportunity. And you get to control your own destiny. You're your own boss. Everyone has rules and things they have to follow, but when the whole hospital is pulling in the same direction, that's when things go well. So your question, what's the business of arthroplasty? What can we expect? We can expect shrinking margins. We can expect a less welcoming environment in the bricks and mortar hospitals as we become less of an attractive business line. Having said that, the demand for our services continues to increase. There's no shortage of arthritic people. I mean, on the horizon, we have the management of obesity with semaglutides, and perhaps, you know, 30 years from now, there'll be less arthritis. But let's face it, that's not going to happen next week. Wall Street seems to think it is, but I don't think they really understand the way this works. So where are we going to go? I think the hope for us, and no one really wants to embrace this, we're not really good with change. If you talk to the big groups, where they make their best money and margins is on value-based care. It's on contracting. It's on delivering a good product for a good price with high quality and delivering service. Pretty soon, CMS is going to go to episodic-based care for everybody nestled within ACOs. We're going to have to learn to live with that. And you know what? We're really good at that. You know, when the bundle started, you know, whether you participated in the bundle or not, your practice changed over the last 15 years. You decreased your length of stay. You stopped using rehab as an out. You started educating patients and optimizing them for better care. We started using TXA universally. We all adopted EROS and aggressive rehab programs. And you know what? We're better for it. That allowed the orthopedic bundles to succeed and has allowed the advent of same-day surgery. And our practice is better for that. And we'll do it again. And we'll thrive in whatever the next challenge they place before us, because orthopedic surgeons evolve and adapt somewhat reluctantly, but they do it. Yeah. And they're very entrepreneurial, and they're very good at what they do. And we deliver great, great care for our patients. So I'm very optimistic about where this is going, but make no mistake about it. We're fortunate in that the last 3 years, the Medicare spending has been level, which has really never happened before. And it's interesting, the healthcare experts are puzzled why this happened, because there's no policy change that really accounts for it. I mean, there's, you know, Medicare doesn't cover the semaglutide, so, you know, it's not a great drug that came in or that's going to be expensive, or, you know, TAVR wasn't introduced, so there were no great expenses. But the reality is that 1 million people died, most of them were elderly, and a lot of them would have got joint replacements and other interventions, and they didn't get them. So spending was level. That's not going to continue. So we need to be ready for that. I think, you know, you guys probably understand that I've never been busier the past 9 months. The backlog of patients who finally came back into the system was enormous. And I'm booked through January, and I hear that from everybody, right? There's, you know, you see patients who keep calling your office looking for a spot because there's no place to put them. And part of that's because of the demands. We don't have enough staff. We don't have enough ORs. We don't have enough anesthesia. We all have the same challenges. We're all paying more money for the same group of employees. So that'll pass. We'll straighten out the immigration problem. We'll do what we did in the 70s and import a bunch of nurses from somewhere else, and maybe even doctors. Who knows? But we're still going to be left with the fundamental fact that we don't really consider healthcare a right in this country, and we don't really know how to pay for it. So how we solve that is beyond my pay grade. Mm-hmm. The penetration of Medicare Advantage has become good in one sense, in that I think it's a great substitute for Medicaid because it's a private payer, it's well run, but it restricts people's access and choice, and people don't like that. But they love to pay less for it with more benefits. So it's the yin and yang, difficult decision kind of thing. But I think Medicare Advantage will continue to increase its penetration.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll take Medicaid off the state's hands and go. And actually, that's what Trump had actually proposed that, but it got lost in the wash. Not a bad idea.
So many amazing and great points there, and you know, thank you. And I think it's, you know, very interesting, you know, the evolution obviously from a kind of sick person model of, you know, the arthroplasty, people are staying in the hospital several days, getting transfused on a lot of opioids, to the more of the evolution of let's get people up, let's, you know, TXA, minimal blood loss, fluid management, you know, rapid rehab protocols just kind of lend themselves more to an ASC, and, you know, really the we can, you know, get away from those kind of bricks and mortars type of things, and obviously we're working on that as well at our hospital. I think you made a lot of excellent and great points. One of the things I wanted to pull out, which what you talked about, which I think our listeners will appreciate, is you talked about the hospital employed systems and contracts, and the first contract being great and the second contract being, you know, maybe not so great. We've talked on several of our podcasts and just in our group internally of there's a large portion of young arthroplasty surgeons and orthopedic surgeons in general that move jobs in their first 5 years. It's about 30, 40, even 50%.
And it's always been that way.
Yeah.
Always been.
I was going to say, have you seen that change?
Or nope.
Why do you think that is?
Well, in the medical profession in general, we make all our decisions based on inadequate data, right? You go to college and you say, I want to go to medical school. I want to help people. But you have no idea what that really means.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you go to medical school and you can be anything from a pathologist to an orthopedic surgeon, right? There's a lot of differences in those fields. Do I want lifestyle? Do I want to sit in a dark room? Do I want to read x-rays? Do I want to help people? Then there's always the blood thing, you know, can I stand being in an operating room? Or some people are fascinated by that, right? Like we all are, obviously. Then where do I do my residency? Well, you know, you did your residency wherever they took you, right? Because, you know, you were happy as hell to be an orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah.
And then where do you do your fellowship? Same thing now, right? It's so competitive. It's like, okay, you know, I love Columbia. I love HSS. I love Stanford. And now you got to go out and practice. And if you're not married, you can go wherever you want, right? So you go where you like or wherever they offer you the most money, depending on the outrageous amount of medical debt that you might have, which is a whole other topic. And I would advise people, if you're married, then go wherever your wife wants, because you're going to be in an operating room 80 hours a week, and it's not going to matter.
Nope.
But that's a whole other topic
about
lifestyle.
Wife, right?
Yeah. So what happens at 5 years is you realize you may have made a mistake, or your partners aren't who you thought they were, or the system you're in, you realize, you know, when you came out as an all altruistic, very idealistic surgeon, like, man, this stinks. I'm doing all this work, and I'm not getting any of the benefit for it. But generally by 5 years, your salary goes up enough that justifies wherever you're working. At 5 to 10 years, it begins to stagnate a little bit because your practice is mature. And if you're in an employed model, they're not going to reward you as quickly as they would, say, if you were eat what you kill out in the wild sort of thing. Some people can tolerate that and understand the benefits of this. Hey, they pay me to travel. They let me do papers. They give me a nurse practitioner. Or they don't. And then they leave. Or they don't like their partners, or they don't like their hospital, they don't like their hospital administrators. And I would tell you, if you don't like your hospital administrator, just wait long enough and they'll change, because they leave every 5 years or become one. But that's always gonna happen.
Sure.
And you know, we're all very independent, talented people, and we can always find a job, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And you may just want to change your geography, you know, like your neighbors, you know, whatever. Or your kids need to go to a different school.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing wrong with that. But yes, for the contract part, they're going to try and attract you to what they don't think is an attractive situation, and they need you. Now, once they've got you, they think they can replace you. Sometimes they can, sometimes they can't.
Sure.
As someone that went through this, I left at 21 years from my first job, but I went from a multi-specialty group to an orthopedic specialty hospital, which was a complete awakening for me. I mean, really different. And that's when I became active at AUKUS and advocacy, because I didn't feel as a group practice guy I really had any experience to offer. And then once I got to HJD and was running the bundle, I felt like I had something to offer. So, and now I'm back in academia at the Brigham, and let's just say it's different, you know, very different.
Sure.
Just to piggyback off of one of your points there at the end, obviously bundles are here to stay. And so the question I sort of have is, what is the next iteration of it? And so we've heard last year and not really much this year, but about disease-specific bundles or disease-based bundles that are sort of maybe the next step after the episodic care bundle. So maybe tell us a little bit about what you think we're going to be looking at coming down the pipeline in regard to that.
Sure. Going back to something Brian said, so Kevin Bozek, good friend, gave a great lecture at the business course yesterday about this. And Kevin's point, and I agree with this, and thinking about it overnight, that we've all been conditioned to deliver care, right? That means interventions, that means stuff, not healthcare, right? Healthcare, which is, as he points out, is two words, means making people more healthy, right? So You can make people more healthy without doing a joint replacement if you treat their arthritis and their other associated comorbidities. So as CMS embraces episode care management and makes it a lifetime thing, or makes it an episode that starts when the disease is diagnosed. So if you think about this in an ACO model, and that's the goal, CMS by 2030 wants every CMS beneficiary in an ACO, whether it's sponsored by a primary care doctor or a hospital. That makes us paid widget guys, right? We don't want that. We want to run the bundle, right? Because then we can offer the conservative stuff beforehand and the optimization stuff to make these patients better. That means making people healthier, right? That means enabling people to cope with their diseases. That means we actually have to put a stethoscope on and be a doctor. So, what are the accompanying comorbidities with arthritis, right? A lot of our patients are depressed. In New York, they're all depressed, right?
That's right, that's right.
They're all on some sort of medication. But that's true everywhere. They have a disability. It may be the first time they've ever dealt with healthcare challenges. They need help. They need support. They need social support. They need maybe even psychological support. They need physical therapy. They need to be active, right? They need to be told, you know, to get in shape. We could talk about weight loss. It's a whole different thing. And I think the medications are going to change all of this. It's going to be easier once they come up with a pill, because I don't think everyone wants to take a needle. There's about a 60% reluctance for that. So if we're in charge of that bundle, then we, on a per member per month basis, you will get paid to take care of arthritis patients. Now, if you're going to just want to do surgery, you're going to get paid your $1,000 to do joint replacement. And that, you're not going to make a living doing that. Even now with the E&M coding, if you have a new patient and you give them a cortisone injection, and you do three of those in an hour, you make more money than you do with a joint replacement. None of us want to do that, right? But sometimes you have to read the tea leaves. We're going to have to manage these people. And the more we embrace that and the more we become participants in this. So there are two pilot projects. There's one in Austin. There's one at Duke. Bill Jeronic and Bolo are doing one at Duke. And Kevin's doing one in Austin. Now, not everyone can do what Kevin does in Austin. It's a highly specialized sort of thing. There's very few orthopedic surgeons, a lot of therapists, a lot of psychologists, a lot of counselors. But we can do some of it. And we're going to have to, at a place like HSS, where basically you take in the young surgeons, you give them all the Medicare patients, tell them to operate on them, and then, eventually you'll get the private pay people. You're not going to want to give all those early arthritis patients to the rheumatologist, because you're going to give up control of them later on. So we're going to have to find some way for this field to be active in patient management. And, we've started some of it with the preoperative optimization, and everyone has a program of some kind with that. And we realize it works when the people are engaged. It doesn't work on everybody. Smoking cessation and weight loss and mental health and wellness counseling, all that goes together, right? I mean, it's all part of treating, the whole person. When I was in medical school, it was the psychosocial model, right? I mean, I'm sure that's debunked by now, but it's taking people as a whole, making them more functional, and trying to get them to have skin in the game, right? I mean, it would be nice if they had some financial burden if they didn't behave. No one's going to go for that, but they probably should. I mean, they should have lower insurance rates, right, if you're in better shape. Yeah. That's the way I look at it. And I would not be one of those people who get the better rates, but, whatever.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I think at all the time we have for today, thanks for being here and awesome pearls and insights for all of our listeners. So we're tuning off now. Welcome to the Young Arthroplasty Group episode of the Augment today. We're joined by Dr. Max Courtney, who's the vice chair of our AUKUS advocacy group. And it's welcome to have him here today to talk about advocacy and all of the policies that they've been trying to push forward in our agendas as arthroplasty surgeons. I'm Brian Chalmers, a hip and knee surgeon out of the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York.
And I'm David Landy, arthroplasty surgeon out of the University of Kentucky in Lexington, Kentucky. So, Dr. Courtney, thank you for joining us. First question we kind of want to talk to you about is, how did you get involved with this in the first place, with advocacy and AUKUS and everything like that?
Great. Thanks for having me, guys. I think this is great that YAG's doing all these podcasts to really help engage its younger members. So advocacy kind of started for me when I was a resident coming to courses like these. AUKUS Health Policy Fellowship is a really great opportunity for younger residents, fellows in training to be getting involved and learning more. So I started that my chief year. Now you can only apply as a current fellow, but back then, and now I'm showing my age because I got some gray hairs, and this was 10 years ago. We did the AUKUS Health Policy Fellowship. I had some mentors within my own practice that were also very involved in advocacy. And it's a great way to learn, to network, to get involved and understand a lot of the issues facing our colleagues.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's just for our younger listeners and listeners in general who may not know what the Health Policy Fellowship is or what it entails or how to apply. Can you just describe?
It's a two-year process. It's not a fellowship. You're not taking time off from your jobs or your training. It's a two-year fellowship. We've been taking five a year recently. AUKUS has been very supportive for funding for this. You get to go to a lot of the meetings. So you're going to go to the AUKUS spring meeting. Obviously, you go here. Usually, we do one trip to the Hill that's just through AUKUS. You'll go to NOLC, which is sponsored through the Academy. And then usually you get to go to one or two of the coding meetings with the ROC or the AMA that we have representatives that go to as well. So in addition to the meetings, you're basically a de facto member of the advocacy committee. So you're on all the advocacy committee phone calls. We usually have one every other month, and you're going to get put on lots of projects. So it's not a passive learning experience. We come out with white papers or position papers on different issues that we publish and can disseminate to our members. And they're good for our patients to read too. So we have health policy fellows that are working on prior authorization. I'm sure we'll get into some of the topics, Medicare physician fee schedule reform, and the fellows are working with, they get paired with faculty members to help kind of get these projects and these position papers through completion. So you apply, application deadline is October 1st of each year, and it's for current fellows and people within their first 5 years of practice that usually apply. So it's a, again, great opportunity to get involved. The networking, you get to, you're going to DC with members of the presidential line and these big names in orthopedics, and you're going to have dinner and talk with them in a much smaller setting than being at this meeting, and you can pick their brain about careers and jobs. It's just a, it's a great way to get involved too.
Along those lines, obviously one of the big agendas for the advocacy group is to bring forward important topics and important things and initiatives that we find and have trouble with in our day-to-day careers and lives as arthroplasty surgeons. What are some of the biggest topics now that the group is pushing forward and really trying to advocate for?
Yeah, there's several issues, and they've been around doing this for about a decade or so now. You've kind of watched some of the issues shift and change. So on the federal level, the biggest issue facing not just us as orthopedic surgeons, but us as physicians, is Medicare physician fee schedule reform. So when the primary care doctors were great at lobbying back in 2020, 2021, our primary care doctors are grossly underpaid in this country, and they have been fighting to try to get more payments for their office visits. And Medicare recognized that, and all of our office visits can get upcoded slightly based upon new criteria and formula. You can go on the AMA's website to look at the office visit coding. And the RVUs, or the relative value units, which is the amount of work that is assigned to them, has gone up. So our primary care doctors were able to get a little bit more bump. Unfortunately, the Medicare physician fee schedule, which is all of the codes in which doctors get paid, has to be cost neutral by statute. So it's one piece of the pie. So if you give the primary care doctors a little bit more for their office visits, you have to take from that pie somewhere else. And instead of Medicare going back to the doctors and saying, well, you know what, we'll cherry pick a couple cases to drop their numbers, they just cut the, what's called the conversion factor, which is the dollar per RVU amount that they reimburse physicians, they just cut that across the board. And we've been going through that for the last 3 years. And our advocacy efforts have really been pushed to trying to help reverse that. Because Congress, it doesn't matter which party is in control of Congress, nobody wants to spend more money. That's a constant bipartisan push that nobody wants to be spending more money. And giving orthopedic surgeons more money is certainly at the bottom of the list. But what I do fear that's going to happen is it's going to limit access to care for a lot of Medicare patients. And right now, if you look at where total joints were paid in 1991, adjusted for inflation, Medicare was paying surgeons over $3,000 for a joint replacement. Now we get about $1,200. And we've gotten better at it. right? So we're certainly more efficient. Even when you guys were training and in medical school, people were spending a couple days in the hospital. Everybody was going to rehab. Everybody was getting a blood transfusion, higher rates of readmission. And now we've gotten much better as an organization, as a subspecialty. We're better trained. We're doing more cases. We're safer. But because of that, our reimbursements actually have been cut. And I do fear while Medicaid patients certainly have issues with access into getting into certain groups, that's going to be the next step. And it's going to take patients standing up when they realize that their wait times are going to be a little bit longer to see their physician. That's probably going to be what it takes to enact actual Medicare physician fee schedule reform specific to arthroplasty.
You think that the surgeons are going to start, you know, just filtering and just making, you know, Medicare patients wait longer? Or do you think there's going to be a trend as Medicare continues to cut reimbursement that a lot of surgeons are just not going to take it at all anymore?
Yeah, I think both of the first thing that you brought up, I think that's already starting to happen. And again, we don't have any studies to say this, right? But opting out of Medicare is a big deal. I mean, joint replacement surgeons, our patients are elderly, and a majority of them have Medicare. They're over 65. And we do want to help people. I mean, that's why we went into joint replacement. We do very successful surgeries. Our patients are very happy. We have excellent outcomes. And when a 85-year-old comes into my clinic who now is wheelchair bound, and I know if I can't get her on for her hip replacement in the next month, she could die, right? These patients get medical complications, immobility, bed sores, blood clots, and being able to help them give their life back, even though they might only have 5 to 10 years left to live, that's why we went into this, to actually help people. But the economics of medicine is going to force what you were talking about, Brian. And what happens is a lot of surgeons can limit their Medicare slots, whether through their call center, whether through their surgery scheduler. To opt out of Medicare, although it's not gotten super popular, if you opt out of Medicare, you have to be out for 2 years. So you can't change your mind 6 months later and say, oh, well, my practice volume is way down. I want to get back into Medicare. They limit you for 2 years. So I think that's why it's been tough for a lot of orthopedic surgeons, joint surgeons specifically, to make that move if they don't have the volume to sustain that. But that's going to be the next step. And there will be a dollar amount in a free market economy that which payment gets so low that, just like Medicaid, and that varies by state, of course, that surgeons might stop taking Medicare.
So how do you guys use the annual meeting to sort of advance your positions, whether it's selecting what's important or letting the larger AUKUS membership know what you're doing?
Yeah, so we're doing one thing specific to this year. We don't do this every year. It's called AUKUS Unity Day. And on Friday, when the meeting starts, you're going to see people all over the meeting. We're going to have booths set up. We have a one-page handout that we're going to be giving to all of the surgeons that can pick up. And we're talking about the big push is the Medicare physician fee schedule reform. We're also encouraging our surgeons to give handouts. We have postcards that they're going to be able to give to their patients in the office. It has a QR code, so you're going to be able to link to your member of Congress. So you're going to be able to send a pre-populated email to the staff of your member of Congress and your senator. So we're going to try to engage patients as well, because we go to the Hill once to twice a year, usually once with AUKUS, once as with the Academy through NOLC, and we need to help get our patients engaged so they can be aware of this too. So that's going to be specific to this year, and that's going to be on Friday of the annual meeting. We also have lots of educational events, right? So there's a health policy session with papers. That's on Sunday morning this year. Hopefully not everybody's out of town and can listen to it. Otherwise, you can be following it virtually online, as all this is going to be recorded. And then those papers will be published in the AUKUS symposium for JOA.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I think obviously all the work you're doing for us as surgeons, but like you mentioned earlier, we really want to make sure that our patients are not suffering from these policies that the government is enacting in Medicare. And I think, like you said, I think one of the most important things is getting patients engaged, just because not even a lot of surgeons and doctors know that these things are going on, let alone the patients in the background. So we're really obviously trying to help them, and patient engagement, I think, is fantastic.
What do you think the future looks like for the advocacy group? So thinking about 10 years from now, do you think there's going to be any movement on new codes for revisions or how those are reimbursed differently? Because that seems to be the one thing that's going to change quite a bit over the next 10 to 20 years, is just the proportion of our volume of surgeons that's dedicated to revisions. Where in the past, maybe people were more comfortable or more able to take whatever kind of financial loss may have been associated with doing those cases. But as they take a greater proportion of our practice it may be more challenging to do that.
Yeah, God, I hope so. And again, all of us, you're being YAG members and the people that are listening to this podcast, right? These surgeons, the first 5 years in practice, we are doing the workload of all of the revisions. And that's just kind of how orthopedics is practiced in the United States, because revisions don't get reimbursed nearly as much as they should. These patients take longer in the office. They have more complications. They're going to call your office more. They're going to spend longer time in the hospital. The surgeries take longer and their outcomes aren't as good, but we still need to be incentivizing surgeons to be taking care of these patients. So we have not opened up the Pandora's box of trying to get revision codes re-reviewed by the RUC, and we can have an entire podcast on that. That's the AMA's organization, the Relative Value Unit Update Committee, that assigns RVUs to each procedure because of what we went through in 2013 and then again 2 years ago with revaluing total hip and knee, right? Then they're going to send out surveys and they're just going to look for it. No one's going to pay us more, unfortunately.
Anything as far as, you know, obviously our young members all listening and YAG members, and we're trying to incorporate a lot more residents and fellows to get involved. Anything that our membership can do just as like on the grassroots or from their perspective to help push advocacy policy or get more involved?
I think you guys have already done a great job. I mean, if you look at where the health policy fellowship was when I was doing it 10 years ago to where it is now, I mean, we just went through applications and we had 16 or 17 applications, and now we take 5, right? When I was doing it, we would get like, I think we had 2 or 3 apply and we would take all 2 or 3. So the organization and having a group like the Young Arthroplasty Group specifically has been able to be getting people more engaged in advocacy. The Young Arthroplasty Group members that are becoming health policy fellows are also now becoming members on the advocacy committee. So they're moving up in the ranks and they're still staying involved. I would just encourage any people just starting in practice just to get involved. And if you don't want to do a 2-year policy fellowship through AUKUS, you can get involved in your state orthopedic society too, right? So state issues, which are just as important, are going to be anything with insurance companies. So prior authorization, tort reform, scope of practice. These are going to be all state issues. Your state orthopedic society you can get involved with. Go to your state orthopedic society meeting. They all have their own committees and groups. You can get involved with that, certainly. And then through AUKUS and the Academy, we're talking more on the federal level. So there's prior authorization on the federal level through a lot of Medicare Advantage bills that we're getting through, the physician fee schedule reform, RUC reform, all that's are going to be federal issues. So you can get involved in both your state orthopedic society and through AUKUS too.
Thank you so much for joining us today and hope everyone has a great meeting.
Great. Thanks again for having me, guys.
Thanks a lot, Max.
Thank you for joining us for the Young Arthroplasty Group Augment podcast channel. Visit AUKUS.org to learn more about how members of American Association of Hip and Knee Surgeons educate, advocate, investigate, and perform humanitarian outreach in the field of hip and knee replacement surgery.